This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
The Woody Guthrie Library of Congress recordings preserved the songs and stories of one of America's most influential folk singers. The recordings were made by my guest, Alan Lomax. Lomax has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. Alan Lomax went on to develop a system for measuring cultural differences in music and dance from around the world. For many years, he's directed a research project on the subject at Columbia University. This week, Alan Lomax won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction for his book The Land Where the Blues Began. So we're going to feature an interview with him from our archives, recorded in 1990. I asked Lomax about the technology he used when he first started making field recordings.
Actually, the first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. For a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. Here in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical, and I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew that what my middle-class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and to some extent for me.
You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a black, respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the black, normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Enormous song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs. they expressed the terrors of their existence.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary, where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers. And Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang. Irene Goodnight was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary. Let the Midnight Special shine its ever-loving light on you. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About an A-bar, and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, see the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose the mom, and let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine your heaven loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table, need the same old thing, not the talker on the table, there's nothing in my pain. Never said a thing about it, having trouble with the man, let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine your ever loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. He, in his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings. It began to go as he lived in the city.
My guest is folklorist Alan Lomax. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with folklorist Alan Lomax. I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to to songs, and gradually the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before you had long pants on?
Why, the policeman would run you right in jail. It'd run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was that? And how old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, Saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jelly Roll Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in my early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, "Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place." And they looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Alan Lomax, recorded in 1990. This week, his book, The Land Where the Blues Began, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction.
If you want to buy a home or farm that can't do nobody harm, or take your vacation by the mountains or sea, don't trade your old cow for a car. You better stay right where you are. You better take this little tip from me. 'Cause Governor Merriam on the radio one day, he jumped up to the microphone and he did say, "Oh, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, friends, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, you better go back to beautiful Texas Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California's a garden of Eden. It's a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the do-re-mi.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Guthrie.
Thank you, Mr. Lomax.
This record was made by the Department of Interior Radio Broadcasting Division on March the 21st, 1940. Alan Lomax speaking.
This is Fresh Air.